The Obama administration wants to cut corporate taxes,
but make sure companies actually pay them.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting this week from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, February 22nd.
Coming up, how are state budgets holding up?
Why does it matter what consumers think about the economy?
And if you want to know what's going to happen economically, maybe all you have to do is check the weather.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace Podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Obama administration today is expected to outline a broad overhaul of the nation's corporate tax code. It proposes cutting the tax rate businesses pay, but it also would close corporate loopholes. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Today's announcement isn't unexpected. In the State of the Union address last month, President Obama said he planned a corporate tax makeover. It wasn't just American companies who took note. Foreign leaders perked up.
Because the U.S. has really one of the strangest sets of corporate tax laws in the world.
Richard Murphy directs Tax Research UK. He says the U.S. charges some of the highest corporate taxes in the world, about 35%. Compare that to Ireland, it charges companies taxes nearer 10%. But the American system lets companies avoid paying by taking advantage of tax shelters. Many U.S. companies park their profits overseas to avoid taxes. And it's not just U.S. taxes they're avoiding.
Frankly, we're seeing these companies not paying taxes in the countries around the world where they're generating their profits because they can shift all their profits back to a tax haven like Bermuda, and the rest of the world is pretty fed up about that.
Fed up with the loopholes. And President Obama's plan is expected to close some of those. At the same time, he'd lower the corporate tax rate by a few percentage points. The combination of the two should bring in more money. Companies will pay a lower tax rate, but pay it on a bigger chunk of their profits. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
For a little background on corporate taxes, let's bring in Charlie Whelan. He's a public policy professor at the University of Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are corporate taxes? Who pays them?
So if you are incorporated as a business, which is a legal distinction, you will calculate the profits that are made by your corporation, which is usually some form of business, and you will pay some percentage in tax to the federal government. Many small businesses will actually have their income passed through as personal income tax, but for the most part, we're talking about large corporations.
How do corporate taxes work today?
They don't work terribly well. So we have a relatively high tax rate in the United States relative to what it might be if we were to close a lot of exemptions. In that respect, it's very similar to the personal income tax, where you get an exemption for interest you pay on your home, you get an exemption for some high medical expenses, you get exemptions here and there, so that by the time we take away all the revenue that is lost from those exemptions, we have to take more of what is not exempted.
So it sounds complicated. Is there consensus that it should be changed?
There is a strong and powerful consensus among people who looks at tax policy in general that lower rates with a broader base, so fewer loopholes, is always preferable to a tax that levies a high rate against some income and virtually none against all these little loopholes that you might be able to find.
Now, let me ask one more question. What's the difference in loopholes and exemptions? Are they exactly the same?
One is a more polite version and the other is a less polite version.
Charlie Whelan, thanks.
Thank you.
These are tough days for state budget makers. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a Washington think tank, says nearly 29 states face budget shortfalls for fiscal year 2013. Among the most indebted, California. The state had hoped an improving economy would boost taxes, but it hasn't worked out that way. From station KPCC, Julie Small reports.
California relies heavily on income tax from the state's wealthiest people. H.D. Palmer is with the California Department of Finance. He says returns from 2010 show that about 1% of California's top earners generated nearly half of the income tax the state collected.
The behavior of a very small sliver of taxpayers can have a significant effect on general fund revenues.
The changing fortunes of that top bracket can add or eliminate billions of dollars of state revenue in a single year. Mac Taylor analyzes fiscal policy for California's legislature.
We can't forecast taxpayer behavior. No one's particularly, you know, good at that.
If markets are up, wealthy taxpayers may sell more stocks and pay more capital gains tax. If markets are down, taxpayers may postpone stock sales. Nobody knows. How taxpayers feel also affects how they pay an estimated quarterly tax. California's Comptroller John Chung says if taxpayers feel optimistic, they tend to pay more.
And if people don't feel comfortable, if they think things may head south with the stock market, they may not pay as much in estimated tax payments.
This year, state number crunchers guessed wrong. I'm Julie Small for Marketplace.
Well, Jeremy, you're in Michigan. How's the state budget there?
Well, amazingly, they have a surplus here.
Wow.
Now, that is not necessarily because things are great. I mean, yes, manufacturing activity is picking up and the car makers are doing better, so tax revenues are coming in. But it's also because the governor here made big cuts in the state budget, including to education. Now, here's why I mention education. Yesterday, I was speaking with somebody who follows the economy here extremely closely, and she said that one of the only ways that Michigan is going to be able to survive in the future is by keeping its educated people here in the state. Right now, a lot of them are leaving. So one of the things that the governor plans to do in his new budget with the surplus is put money back into education.
So he took it out to make the surplus, and now he's going to use that money and put it back.
Now he's going to go right back in.
Fair enough. Any other impressions that have jumped out in your time in Michigan?
Well, I went out to a cafe yesterday to get some coffee, and I asked the woman behind the counter, well, how is business? And she said, well, it's getting better, but not because the economy is getting much better. It's getting better because it hasn't snowed much this year, and it's warmer than usual. People are more willing to go out and buy things like coffee. Now, the interesting thing is we then went off to go do an interview with the CEO of Domino's Pizza, Patrick Doyle, and it started to snow, and here's what he said about that.
Snow is a wonderful thing for business. Seriously.
Really?
Oh, absolutely. For Domino's, we love it. When you get a little bit of snow, people stay home and say, I'm not going to go out. I'll order in.
So as you can see, Adrian, some people like the weather, some people don't, but it is extremely important to the economy here.
Yeah, and pizza does strike me as a cold weather food, I guess.
It was very tasty after the interview.
The word mademoiselle seems as French as the Eiffel Tower, but from now on it will be banned from official government forms, and French women's groups are claiming victory. Up until now, French women were forced to declare their marital status as either mademoiselle or madame every time they filled out a tax form. The BBC's Hugh Schofield reports from France.
It's been around since the Middle Ages, denoting a young unmarried lady. French women's organizations have been campaigning against it for years. They say it's unfair for there to be, in the state's eyes, two categories of women and only one of men, monsieur. Not all French women agree, it has to be said. Many quite like the old-fashioned courtesy that comes with mademoiselle. Emily Dufour is a young French woman living in Bordeaux. She doesn't agree with the change. She's happy to be called mademoiselle.
I think it's great for women who want to feel younger, so I would remain with mademoiselle if I had the choice.
The French language has no middle ground, like the English ms, that doesn't imply married or unmarried. And the French government has now agreed with women's advocacy groups. So from now on, in government forms at least, all French women are madame. In Bordeaux, I'm the BBC's Hugh Schofield for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
This Friday, we're going to get a piece of economic data that comes once a month and is watched closely by economists and investors alike. Consumer sentiment. It's a measure of how consumers are feeling about the economy, and it's put together by Thomson Reuters and the University of Michigan. Well, we've got the professor who directs the survey here in our studio in Ann Arbor to talk with us now. His name is Richard Curtin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with some of the people that we've been talking to across the state of Michigan and get your reaction. Let's take a listen.
It's getting better. From where I stand, it's just down.
It could use some work.
I think it's improving.
The economy is seeming to be picking up slowly but surely.
It's a little down right now, but I think it's going to come back up.
I think it's a recovery.
So a lot of different viewpoints about the state of the economy. What do you make of that?
Well, it's typical. I mean, this recession was very severe. But I think the thrust of what they said is reflected in the national research, that people think it's improving, but they don't think it's there yet.
Is that always the way it is, just a mixed bag like that?
It typically is, but that mix only lasts a short period of time. What's distinctive about this recovery is that mix has lasted a relatively long period of time.
And is this how you do your survey? You just go out and ask people how they're feeling about the economy?
We do. We select every household in the United States has an equal probability of being selected. And we start out with a very straightforward, simple question, trying to get them to give their opinion to us by simply asking, how are you doing and why? And they tell us in their own words.
And how have things changed over the course of the years that you have been doing this? Have things gotten better, worse? Are there any broad trends?
We look at cycles. And so in Michigan or in the country as a whole, it was very grim in the 1980s, in the early 1980s. And it is still very grim now. I think the big difference is that people have decreased the prospects over the longer term this time more than we've ever seen in the past.
Now, why does this number matter when you look at it compared with the jobs report that we get every month or the housing index that we get? Why is consumer sentiment so important?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that consumers account for 70% of the economy. And so as consumers feel more optimistic, they tend to spend more. And the second is that it is an accurate leading indicator. So it helps us understand for policymakers how the economy will evolve in the year ahead.
What does this data tell us about ourselves as Americans? Do you see a hopeful people that we always like to feel better than maybe we should, or what?
You know, one of the characteristics of the U.S. consumer has been it's very optimistic looking forward. And that is a very important characteristic for people to have, to be optimistic about their situation. But they go to some extremes. Of course, we saw in the housing bubble that people just thought it wouldn't end.
Feel a little too good about things.
Too good. And they could feel a little too bad at times at the depths of a recession. But one of the things our index does is it always turns when things are really great, people become suspicious and skeptical that it will continue. And when things are absolutely horrid, they tend to move up.
We're here this week because there's a primary here in Michigan next Tuesday. What do these consumer sentiment numbers mean for politicians, for elections?
If you look at the long history of our series going back to the early 50s, and you look at re-elections, it's never misforecasted who the eventual winner was. And this time, the data is strongly against President Obama. Hmm. But of course, this is an election between two people. And how that works out, you know, we'll have to wait and see who the candidate is.
But you're saying that just based on the data, which you say has never misforecast the situation, that President Obama would not be reelected.
Yes. You know, if you look at ask consumers about the economy, they say it's improving, especially unemployment. You ask a consumer about how they're doing personally, it's near the worst level it's ever been. And we have 50% or more of consumers who did not expect an income increase in the next year. This is absolutely unprecedented in our history.
So they're saying things are getting better broadly, but for me, I'm not seeing it yet.
Yes. And, you know, this is the second shoe. You know, when unemployment rate declines, more and more of those who dropped out are likely to come back into the labor force. And more people will get less satisfied with their current situation, knowing that the economy is improving. And so I think this is going to be a difficult recovery, and it's not going to be, you know, we're going to look back in some years over this, and this will certainly be in the broader period we think of as the economic difficulties of this age.
Do consumers feel better in an election year about the economy?
Oh, they do. If you look at the last 10 elections or the last 40 years, GDP actually peaks in the first quarter of the election year, where we are now. Hmm. And consumer sentiment tends to peak a quarter before that. Why does GDP increase in the election year? There's lots of theories. Now, the average is higher, but it's, there's lots of economic reasons why that happens. And in the past, it used to be thought, you know, among consumers that the government was simply doing all they could to make the economy more favorable for their election. But I think this kind of political cycle is laid over a broader economic cycle. But it's certainly true that what consumers are responding to is a real gains in the economy in the first part of the year of an election.
How does the economy look to you right now?
I think it's improving. I wish it was improving a little faster than it is, but it's on a growth path. And the important thing is if that is sustained, and there's lots of worries out there from oil to Europe and everything in between.
Richard Curtin is the director of the Reuters University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
So I was watching TV here last night in Michigan, Adrian, and in one short commercial break, I saw a Romney ad, a Santorum ad, and a Romney Super PAC ad, all three in just a two-minute break. And there was an ad for Sandals Resorts in there, too. But, you know, it's pretty snowy and cold here, so I guess that makes sense. But with 6 days to go until the primary, the candidates and their supporters, these Super PACs, are spending big money to convince the people here to vote for them. We ventured out into the streets of Ann Arbor to ask some voters how they're feeling about the economy and the election. Let me just get your name.
Monica Lovell.
And what do you do here?
I'm a shift supervisor at a bagel shop.
So how do you feel about the economy right now?
I think the economy's been crap for a long time. I just think that people are really starting to pay attention.
Are you following the election?
I am.
And what are you thinking at this point?
I think that the Republican Party is in a world of mess right now. They don't have a good candidate, and my vote's going to Obama again. You know, he wasn't given a great chance to begin with.
Can I get your name?
Vincent Patsy.
What do you do here in Ann Arbor?
I work at 7-Eleven.
And how long have you worked there?
6 months.
And what were you doing before that?
I was unemployed. I mean, I moved back in with my parents after graduating from the university.
So how are you feeling about the economy now? You've been employed for the last 6 months.
It's going to get much worse when the government debt bubble explodes.
So what are you thinking about this election?
Oh, I'm Ron Paul supporter.
What do you think he'll be able to do?
End the foreign wars. That's where a lot of our budget's going right now. About $1 trillion overseas are spent on foreign wars. All the other candidates basically have the same foreign policy. But the thing is, they're not going to attract Ron Paul supporters. They just aren't. They don't get it.
Some voices from the streets of Ann Arbor.
And Jeremy, just in case you're ever in the market for a new job, NASA is looking for some good eaters.
Huh.
Yeah, the agency.
The space food? I don't want to eat that space food.
The agency is looking for people to eat space food for 4 months. They want to figure out how to feed astronauts on any future mission to Mars. And it's not going to be astronaut ice cream and Tang all the time. Among other things, NASA wants to figure out how to keep future explorers from getting menu fatigue and build a cookbook for future crews. The job requirements include a bachelor's degree, an interest in space exploration, and, of course, the willingness to eat pretty much anything.
You know, Adrian, I saw a magazine article on my way to Michigan the other day about people who participate in these eating competitions where they go and they eat as many
like a million
slices of pizza or hot dogs or stuff like that. And I was thinking to myself, gosh, that sounds like it would be a fun hobby, but probably not a very healthy one.
I don't think so, actually. I think you'd feel gross all the time.
That's possibly true. In Ann Arbor, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.